We're
There we
good.
go.
Please go ahead.
Cool. Title of my talk is going to be Approaching the Neutron EDM, so something as bizarre as ultra-quiet mercury atoms. And so this is sort of an introduction that you've probably seen many times before. So we are interested in answering or trying to contribute to an answer to some of the probably most fundamental questions that we have in physics, which is why does the universe contain so much matter and so little antimatter? So what is the origin of orogenesis that's breaking CP symmetry? And as we know from the cosmic microwave background, we can calculate or measure the number of particles related to the number of photons that we have in the universe. And as you know, there's like an 8 orders of magnitude or so tension. Also, the predictions and the so standard model predictions and the measurements are like few percent accuracy. So there's something missing there. That's one part. And the other ingredient is, so my background is in precision measurements and optical physics and laser spectroscopy and so on. And our big hero is, let's say, Arthur Schaller, who said, never measure anything but frequency. So we're trying to map all problems we're having to effectively a frequency measurement in the end. So these two ingredients, sort of as the preludium, we now go into the EDM measurements. This is a chart that you are very familiar with. So we have many different origins of possible CP violations that can be around, and then they map down an energy scattersome that we can effectively measure. We are most interested in this nuclear EDM down here, which could be the EDM of the proton or the neutron, that we could measure it via various means, either directly on the neutron or the proton. And there's also the approach to look at diamagnetic atoms or molecules. And this is the approach that we are going to be taking. And in between it, there's nuclear shift moment, which I would also talk about in a minute, but you're probably also familiar with, which is important. So the shift moment tells us how much of the nuclear EDM penetrates to the outside and is then actually measurable if we look at the electronic shell. This relativistic effect and all relativistic effects go as the z to the third power, so the nuclear charge. So it makes sense to work with heavy elements, with heavy atoms. And there's many experiments and look into EDM measurements using xenon, which is heavy, mercury, which is heavy, and also radioactive radium. One of my most sort of favorite experiments is this one here. That's the old Washington experiment using room temperature vapors of mercury to do EDM measurements. So they have little glass containers here about 1 centimeter in size at room temperature. So have they're paraffin coated from the inside, so don't have spin-changing collisions between the atoms and the walls of the container. And they have coherence times of minutes, let's say. And then, as you know, all EDM measurements require a strong electric field superimposed with a B field, so a magnetic field that provides a guiding axis for atoms to spin precess within this guiding field. And in this experiment, they had four different cells stacked on top of one another, that they have a ground plane in the middle, and then they have two cells on top and two cells below. So they have different sort of pointings of the electric and the magnetic field, and they also have sort of reference cells that are free of an electric field. This is all, well, each individual cell is centimeter size, so this is pretty small, like a few 10 centimeters in size in total. And then they have UV light that spin polarizes the atom and then also lets them to spin precess in the guiding B field. And then they look at variations or search for variations of the spin precession frequency radared optically. And if there was a shift in spin precession frequency, this would be the interaction between the strong electric field and the EDM. And if you don't see anything, that's a limit to the EDM of the atom. Now, just the EDM of a mercury atom might be very interesting, but you can calculate it. You can show that you can make assumption as to what could be the origin of this EDM that you are measuring. And it turns out that the mercury EDM, the nuclear mercury EDM, is more than 90% dominated by the neutron EDM. And if you believe that is true, then you can put a limit to the neutron EDM using the nucleus of mercury as a measurement. And from what I understand, this is a competitive limit to the neutron EDM. Now, these experiments are great. They make great progress, but progress kind of starting from like 2010 maybe or so, because they have exceeded the technical capabilities of these room temperature experiments. In the bottom left here, you see an error budget, which is dominated by the motion of these cells here. So these cells, they try to use good materials, good meaning materials that don't contain any metals, because metals would feel a force when you subject them to a strong electric field. And still, these cells move by 2 nanometers. So measurements take place over months and months, and then you flip the or reverse the voltages, which are many 10 kilovolts. And by this sort of reversing electric fields, you get a motion of these cells by 2 nanometers. And this 2 nanometer motion is what kills you in the end. And this is the main contribution to the error budget here. There's also other effects like leakage current, which is very classical. There's the V here is the speed of the atoms inside the container. So it's also like a classical quantity. And I would claim that all of these systematic effects are the most dominant ones are related to really classical effects, like motion of a container and residual velocity of the atoms and so on. So it might be great to go from this very classical limitation to some more quantum regime, which allows you to, first of all, live in a much smaller container, and then probably also much better controlled container, where you have better control of the spin of the atoms and better control of the velocities, namely by reducing the bottle velocities to near zero. This approach was taken already with radium. This is the old argon experiment, where people did laser cooling of radium atoms, then trapped them what we call an optical dipole trap. So you have an optical tweezer, you have this focused strong infrared dipole trapping beam that confines the atoms. Then you can squeeze these atoms in between these two electric field plates here. In this case, they are spaced by 2 millimeters or so, so they can be much smaller than the previous experiment I showed. And putting an electric field of plus minus 15 kilovolts then leads to an electric field strength of about close to like 100 kilowatt per centimeter. And then you have an external guiding field, and you can watch the atom spin process inside this configuration. And yeah, effectively, it's the same experiments as the Mercury experiment I showed you before, but here with code atoms. Now, radium has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage being it has a very deformed nucleus. So this amplifies the electric dipole moment that you want to search for. The disadvantage is that these deformed nuclei tend to be unstable. And this is also true for radium. So it's radioactive. It's very hard to get hold of these atoms, and it's hard to laser cool them. So these experiments took place with 200 atoms. So there's a price you have to pay, but also an advantage. So this was the starting point for the one side of the motivation to do what I will show you now, which is the construction of what we call the Q-Mercury experiment in Bonn. Q meaning quantum, so we're going to do a quantum Mercury experiment here. So we are fusing in the end the room temperature Mercury experiment with the ultra-cold laser cooling approach from the radium. Staying on the non-radioactive side, because it's the university lab, we want to work with the heaviest non-radioactive element that we can, or that can be laser cooled. And this turns out to be mercury. So work with mercury, hoping to improve over the radium experiment by a lot. And this a lot is, first of all, atom number, as I will show you later. And we can go well beyond 200 atoms, and also to improve on the technology in the sense of reducing the gap between the electrodes and so on. And down here is a chart, what in German we say, Papier ist geduldig, so which means something like a paper can wait a long time. So you can, whatever you can write on paper, the experiment will tell only afterwards how well this works. But this is our Seattle experiment. And then if we make estimations of like a conservative experiment with conservative atom numbers, so this is 10 to the 6 atoms with this coherence time of 100 seconds and a certain E field strength, there's something that's more like optimistic. And you see that in the optimistic case, the design sensitivity is 2 orders of magnitude better than the one order of magnitude better of what has been achieved by the Washington experiment. And then long-term, we're trying to sort of stress this Q and Q-mercury, this is a quantum system. So we're hoping to entangle the atoms, and with entangled atoms, then we would not scale as 1/(1/√) of the atom number. We will go to the Heisenberg scale, as we scale as 1/(1/) the atom number. Then, of course, you have millions of atoms. The scale is much, much better. This would then allow us to go like another 2 orders of magnitude better, and then in the end be like 3 orders of magnitude better than previously existing experiments. Okay, so this is the layout, and now we're taking baby steps towards this goal. This is the Lebesgue scheme of Mercury. So Mercury has a disadvantage, which is that all of the transitions that we use for laser cooling and manipulation and state detection and so on are in the UV. So the most convenient ones are 254 nanometers, which is already pretty deep in the UV. There's another cooling transition at 185, which is even deeper in the UV. So we also do a lot of laser development. We will start with this 254 nanometer, which is our principal cooling transition. So we build magneto-optical traps that you know very well. So we have six counter-propagating beams, and we have a B-field in Helmholtz configuration. Then we confine atoms that are evaporated from oven here in the center, and we trap them. Trapping takes, I don't know, 100 milliseconds or so. Then we can trap atoms for seconds or minutes in this three-dimensional trap formed by these mod beams. Then we can take images of them, we can manipulate them, we can detect them, we can do with them whatever we want. This is now a gallery of the various isotopes of mercury that we managed to cool. So mercury has many different isotopes, and it's good to have access to many of them because they have different properties, especially different scattering properties. And we're most interested in the mercury 199, but it's also convenient to be able to work with the bosonic isotopes, especially if you want to cool atoms through evaporation, so through collisions. It's good to have access to also other isotopes. Then we did what any atomic physics person does, which is to optimize the cooling process. And this is now a study that took over a year or so. So first we optimized on atom number, and then you see the certain parameters. So in the end, these are cuts through multidimensional parameter space of via the detuning of the laser light, the saturation parameter, and the gradient field we're using. Then we can sort of find our way through this parameter space to optimize on temperature. And then we say, okay, we have many atoms, but maybe we also need them at low temperature. So then we optimize for temperature, and we find, maybe the parameters that we need for a large atom number are different from those that we need for a small temperature. And also, we want to minimize the cloud size because we want to like a small size. So we have small B and E field gradients. So then we can also optimize for cloud size. And at some point, we remember our atomic physics lectures that in the end, phase-based density is the quantity that matters. So first, we optimize for density. Then we also optimize for space-based density. And well, maybe I don't know if you can see it, but here in this orange, reddish color, we reach phase-based densities on the order of 10 to minus 6 or so. So this is then our starting point of this where we are today, that we can provide samples of mercury atoms with 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 atoms at phase-based density of 10 to minus 6 or so. And this is a promising starting point to load atoms into a dipole trap. And these are the first images of mercury atoms loaded into a dipole trap. We're currently trying different dipole trapping lasers, trying to optimize the loading efficiency, trying to look at the scattering parameters between these atoms that we use for evaporative cooling. Then eventually we will sort of squeeze this dipole trap in between the two capacitor plates of to generate this electric field. Then I guess we're in a good position to start with the actual EDM measurements. So just to keep in mind, this is sort of our Vega set, 10 to the 8 atoms. At 200 microKelvin temperature for the bosons, which are harder to cool, let's say. Mercury 199, which is the isotope that we're interested in for the EDM measurements. We have fewer atoms, but they are colder. So in terms of phase-based density, this is very similar. And this is our starting point for dipole trap loading. Okay, now I will take a little bit of a detour. And this, I think, connects in some way to the previous talk because it relates to the shape of the nucleus. And as I said before, the EDM we are measuring penetrates to the outside and is amplified through the shape or the sort of non-spherical components of the nucleus. So it's interesting to learn something about the nuclear shape of mercury, but probably also of other elements because other people are also doing EDM measurements and beyond standard model physics searches with other elements and predominantly heavy elements. So We have to dive a little bit now into atomic physics, and I will try to take you through this here. So imagine you have an atom, and imagine you have different transitions that connect different electronic orbitals. Now I will label my isotopes, and we wanted to spectroscopy different isotopes because we want to learn something about the nucleus. If we have different isotopes, the only thing that changes is it's the nucleus in the end, because we change the number of neutrons in the nucleus, but the electronic cloud does not change, so the charge state stays the same. The electron cloud will respond a little bit to the growing number of neutrons in the nucleus, but really the only quantity that we change a lot is the nucleus. So we label our isotopes I and J, and for now we only have one transition that we call alpha. So the isotope shift, so the frequency difference for an electronic transition going from J to I, is comprised of various components. One is the field shift, because the nucleus gets larger, there's one more neutron in there, and so the wave function of the electrons interact with the nucleus. So there's a size effect, let's say, that we call the field shift. It has a component of the electronic orbitals, and as a component of the change in the radius, if you want, a change in the size of the nucleus going from I to J. It's called the field shift. It usually dominates for atoms, and is on the gigahertz scale in terms of frequency. Then, of course, the nucleus also gets heavier by adding one neutron. So there's a response of the electronic orbital to the nucleus getting heavier by one mass number. It's called the mass shift. This one dominates for the light nuclei, and it's typically on the megahertz or gigahertz scale. And then we have higher order terms of all of this. So we have a second order field shift, a second order mass shift, but we also have many other higher order terms that I kind of sum into this one here. This would actually be a sum of various different higher order terms, but I just put this one here, which again is a consequence of the change of the size of the nucleus or the shape of the nucleus. And the response of the electronic orbitals. And then since a few years, people are also interested to use this type of measurements to search for new physics. So suppose there was a coupling between a neutron and an electron. So you have couplings, a new scalar boson that would couple or provide an interaction between hadrons and leptons. In our case, the neutron and the electron. This would be the coupling. This would be the new physics that relates to the change in the number of neutrons in the nucleus. And then you can speculate about the size of these couplings. They can be zero or can be on the hertz scale, the kilohertz scale, depending as to whether there exists such a hypothetical new particle. Okay, but the bottom line is we can use these isotope shift measurements for all kinds of interesting things, to search for new physics, also to learn something about the conventional planar nucleus. Now, okay, this is the motivation for the a new hypothetical particle that will couple electrons and neutrons. There's been a hype of papers in the past 4 years or so. So they will couple via or are modeled via a Yukawa potential, and they have a range that corresponds to the Compton wavelength. Back to our isotope shift. Now, what do we do? Each measurement just returns one value, one isotope shift, but we have many, many parameters here that we need to fit, many different components. So we need to do two things. One is we need many isotopes, so we can measure many values and compare many of these numbers. And the second, we need many transitions that we use for these measurements. And it turns out that we need almost as many transitions as we have isotopes available. So if we have, I don't know, five isotopes, we can extract four of these parameters. To make all of this here a little bit more, say, nicely looking, or to visualize it nicely, we first stay with the field shift and the mass shift because they are linear. They are the largest contributions. What we now do is we normalize by the mass shift, because this is the same for all transitions. So independent of what the transition is, what the electronic orbital is, we just increase the atom number, or the nuclear mass by one mass number. So this is a convenient and very simple factor to look at. So we normalize the entire equation to this mass shift here. And then we use a second optical transition that we call beta here to remove this term here. And then the magic goes from here to here. So now we look at the isotope shift relation between two optical transitions. So this is the relation between a transition beta compared to a transition alpha here with a prefactor. So this is just a linear slope, if you want. This is just an offset. This has lost the mu, so the change in the mass. So the left side, what is printed here in black, is just a linear curve. And then there's the higher order contribution that we're interested in. All of what we call the second order field shift and so on, second order terms, and the new physics component. But importantly, the black one here is a linear slope, it's a linear equation, and the rest is something that is beyond linear. And this is called the King plot, and it looks like this. So this is now a pretty confusing one already, because it's it relates two transitions. This one here is all in calcium now, just a random example. And this is in calcium ions. This is a transition called 866 nanometers, another transition called 397 nanometers. Let's look only at the blue data points here. We see that all of these blue data points here align on this yellow slope. So it's indeed a linear curve. Then we can look at, we can zoom in into these data points, and within the error bars, they all align on the slope here. So that means that at the time of measurement here in calcium, everything could be explained by the field and mass shift, and there were no higher order terms, new physics, anything else that would be interesting or would go away from the classical mass and field shifts. And for the past, I don't know, 30 years or so, there's been dozens and dozens of these measurements and all kinds of elements. And they were used to determine the sizes of nuclei, for example. Now, if we want to go further, we need atoms that we can laser cool. So we can do sort of precision measurements on them. And we need atoms with many isotopes. We need atoms that are preferably no nuclear spin, so we can stay clear of hyperfine structure. And we need as many optical transitions as possible. The narrower, the better, because narrow transition, of course, allows us to measure more precisely. And in the end, we end up with the very same elements that people have been using traditionally for optical clocks. So this is calcium, strontium, and so on. Magnesium also, they're used for optical clocks. Zinc, cadmium, and mercury. Here's the group 3B, 2B elements. And maybe also terbium and nobelium, so the heavy lanthanides down there. So kind of funny that the elements that people have experimented with for a long time already also want this to turn out to be favorable for these new physics and isotope shift measurement ideas. Okay, this is an example of if you want to search for new physics, how well you have to measure. And this, you always get a exclusion plot that relates the coupling strength between the electron and the neutron in some units to the mass of the particle. And then the mass of the particle, and the range is related to the size that you're probing. And in atomic physics, we can probe anything between, let's say, a fraction of an angstrom, which is the size of a nucleus, to a couple of femtometers, I'm sorry, a couple of angstrom, which is the size of the electronic orbital, to like a femtometer. So we're in this range here. And you see that for precisions on the range of a hertz or so, which is well doable in optical clocks, we can start to exclude parameter ranges that have thus far not been excluded. Okay, and now a little bit of a history over the past couple of years on ytterbium. So this is work, I believe, by Vlada Vuletic from MIT. He did spectroscopy on two transitions in ytterbium. And if you look at them, of course, they all align on the slope and they seem to align nicely. But if you zoom in, you get some residuals. So let's take the right plot here first. So you see, if you zoom in, the data points don't align on the slope, but they get this because it's staggering. So they are down, up, down, up. So not exactly on the linear slope, but they deviate from the slope, also outside of the error bars. And now you can reverse the x-axis here and renormalize a little bit. This is what people do to make this stagger a little bit better visible. And if you then in this reversed order, look at the residuals. So you keep the topology, we say, but you just sort of mess around with the data a little bit to amplify the staggering. You get an up, down staggering. So you have some nonlinearity, and you want to quantify this nonlinearity in some way by looking at the topology. whether it's up, down, or whether it's up, down, down, up, or down, up, up, down. And in this configuration for this particular case, it's up, down, up, down. And afterwards, there have been a wealth of papers saying, well, we found evidence for nonlinear isotope shift in the search for a new boson. And there was the next paper. There's not even like one nonlinear, there are two nonlinearities. Evidence for two source include nonlinearity in the spectroscopy search for a new boson. There was an observation of a nonlinearity in a generalized king plot. So generalized meaning three-dimensional king plot in the search for a new boson. And then came the spoiler from Dima Butka's group in Mainz saying, precision determination of isotopes in your turbine and implications for new physics. And already in the abstract here, it says, we show that the observed nonlinearity in the joint ytterbium king plot analysis can be accounted for by deformation of the ytterbium nuclei. So all of these previous papers that were not really claiming, but suggesting to have found nonlinearities in the search for a new boson, in the end turned out to be deformations of the nucleus. So this tells us that this entire storyline might not lead to detecting new particles, but might lead us to learn something about the shape of the nuclei. So we learn that there's not only just the second order field shift, but that many, many other terms like the quadrupole deformations. And then you can be in superposition of being sad because this will spoil your search for new particles. But you can also be happy about it because it gives you a new avenue to probe quadrupole deformations and deformations and learn something about the nucleus itself. This is a plot that I find very intuitive or that I learned a lot from. So this is sort of part of the, not the periodic table, but the nuclide chart. It's only the even proton and even neutron numbers, so it's only a subset, and it shows in color code the degree of quadrupole deformation. So the more red or the more orange, the heavier deformed the nuclei are, and you see that ytterbium is sitting pretty much on this blob here. So this explains why people saw these nonlinearities, and also explains why these nonlinearities were not beyond standard model physics, but were nuclear deformations. Now, my group were thinking to be smart and we want to use mercury and be sitting here in this valley here near the proton shell closure. So proton shell closure is at 82, mercury proton number is 80. So we're pretty close to the shell closure here and we should be suffering much less from the nuclear deformations. So like 1.5 years ago, we set out to do isotope shift spectroscopy on mercury. And because we have so many isotopes, we also need to do spectroscopy on many transitions. And this is what we did. We have five suitable isotopes. So we have many transitions. And we hoped to have less quadrupole deformations as compared to ytterbium. And in the end, we did spectroscopy in all of the transitions here that are labeled here in colors. So 254 nanometers, two of the 310 nanometers, and one at the 36 nanometers. I will just talk about a combination of three of these transitions here. So we're comparing this S to P with two P to D transitions. Now it's three transitions. So we don't plot in like a two-dimensional king plot, but in a three-dimensional king plot, where all of these data points are, on a curve. And this curve is within a plane. And then we look at the residuals of our data points from the plane, so the distance of the data points from the plane. And what we see is this up, down staggering again, suggesting a nonlinearity that's comparable to the ytterbium one. And now we don't do this only for this combination of these three transitions here, but we do that for a combination of all of the transitions we are measuring. And then in the end, we plot this in what we call a nonlinearity measure. That is, we look at the topology of these data points here, whether they are up, down, up, down. So up, down, we call zigzag. This is what we would put on the positive side of the y-axis. If it were down, up, would be on the negative side of the y-axis. And if it's up, down, down, up, we call this smiley face. And up, down would be on the left, on the lower part of the x-axis. Okay, and now we plot all our data points that we get from combinations of three transitions in here. And we see, oh my God, they are all scattered around the place here. Also within the error bars, they are all in different positions. They all contain contributions of this zigzag and of the smiley face nonlinearity. And some of them are larger, some of them are smaller. There's one here that you can't see well. And that's kind of complicated. But we also see that all of these here, so the one in the first and third quadrant contain S states. So this is P to D compared to P to S, another P to D compared to P to S, and so on. This is S to P compared to P to D. So all of these here contain S states, but this one here is comparing P to D with P to D. It does not contain S state, and it's lying sort of on the orthogonal. And this lets us to, or lets theory to put models to try to understand what we're seeing here. We had a model like a year ago where we thought we understood very well what we are seeing. Now we measured again, and we're not so sure anymore. So I'm kind of trying to shy away from putting a model here, but it seems that that we have sort of what we're expecting here is a quadruple deformation that's along this line here. And so it seems that data we are seeing is compatible with quadruple deformations, also for Mercury, and also unexpectedly large. So looking at this plot here again, we were expecting relatively small quadruple deformations, but it seems that quadruple deformations in a Mercury are larger than expected. Okay, yeah, we're currently sort of putting all the numbers together and writing things up. And this will then in the end conclude our Mercury work, because it seems that at least to search for new particles, Mercury might not be the suitable system because the deformations are just too large. Okay, but there's many other valleys here where we expect nuclear deformations to be small. One valley is near the shell closure for the proton S50, one is near 28, and one is near 20. Coinciding with the atoms that can be laser cooled, there were cadmium, zinc, and calcium. And we do spectroscopy on all of these. Specifically, we have an experiment on calcium where we build in what we call an optical clock. So it's a beam clock that uses a relatively complicated Ramsey body interferometer scheme. And we do this simultaneously co-located. So we do spectroscopy in the same place at the same time for two different isotopes. And we do this on two different transitions. One is an S to P transition, which is an intercombination line. So it's forbidden through the intercombination law. And the other transition is an S to D transition. So it's a delta J equals two transition, which is also forbidden for dipole transitions. And then we do spectroscopy on these two transitions here over five isotopes. Then are all within the nuclear shell closures, and then try to have millihertz resolution on the isotope shifts that can then be compared to already existing data on calcium ions and highly charged ions, primarily from Pete Schmidt's group at PDB. Yeah, and then there's details here. We have optical transitions to read out the ground state. We have optical transitions to read out the excited state that should allow, hopefully, for a large signal to noise. And just yesterday, we succeeded for the first time detect this 458 nanometer to photon transition. So yeah, progress is small, but we are slowly and steadily getting there. The other element we are endeavoring into is zinc. Zinc is sort of in the means. It's not very light and also not very heavy, but it has many stable isotopes. And here we're trying to explore the intermediate range. Not as light, not as spherical, not as nice as calcium, but also not as relativistic as mercury. So somewhere in the middle, it's near the proton shell closure, and it has sufficiently many stable bosonic isotopes. Disadvantage here, and very similar to mercury, is the UV wavelength. So the main cooling transition is at 240 nanometer, and then the second stage cooling is at 308 nanometers. So this requires development of new lasers, which is going to be the last topic of my talk here. I want to spread a little bit the word about our deep UV laser development, in case some of you is interested also in or might want to use UV lasers. Then this is something we could maybe offer or advise on. So we're developing lasers at 240 nanometers, which is pretty deep in the UV for spectroscopy of zinc and laser cooling of zinc. So this was about a year ago, our first spectroscopy or Doppler broad spectroscopy of zinc, where we determined the transition of the to pretty high accuracy and showed for the first time we were able to build lasers 240 nanometers. Then together with colleagues in Berlin, we used laser-induced fluorescence on the cryogenic beam of zinc atoms to measure the isotope shifts on the 240 nanometer transition here. That's this paper down here. And in the end, this is the layout how the laser system works. So yeah, I don't want to go into details here, but it's a pretty complicated laser system. Now that we can build lasers at 240 nanometers, we can go one step further and thereby use the very same laser system and combine it with another, get even more complicated laser system, in which we use the 240 nanometers, inject them into a bow tie cavity. And the bow tie cavity is operating on an infrared transition, where we have like a couple of watts of infrared power that they amplify by a factor of 100 or more. Send all of this into a CRBO and then do some frequency generation in the CRBO crystal. That is, we sum the frequency of a photon of the UV light with another photon of the infrared light to generate light at 185 nanometers. 185 is the principal transition in mercury. It's very broad, and that should allow us to amplify the signal to noise on our EDM measurements of mercury by the ratio of line widths of the 185 nanometers as compared to the 254 nanometers. That's about a factor of 100 or so. So we expect an increase in signal to noise by a factor of 100 for our mercury EDM measurements. And talking about mercury again, I'm sort of closing the loop now that for the pan-EDM experiment in Grenoble, we are together with the Heidelberg community people developing a new laser system, where a master student just started actually yesterday here with us in Bonn to set the system up. So it's based on a relatively newly available VCSEL laser that's highly stable, lots of power, nice mode, and so on, many watts in the infrared. The frequency doubled to the green, and again, frequency doubled to the UV. And that should allow it to give sort of record powers of light, also highly stable, widely tunable. It's frequency stabilized by locking to one of these cavities here. That should hopefully be a new platform to improve, hopefully, the precision of mercury and neutron EDM measurements. Okay, this closes the loop back to the mercury EDM. This is a picture of the team. And yeah, ends my talk. And thanks a lot for your interest and your patience. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Just to be
Yes.
clear. Yeah. So I'll open the room for questions and let's see if you can hear them. Otherwise, I'll repeat them in the microphone. Is that working now?
It should be charged today.
Anybody with a question? Yes, please. You're pretty close.
I'm optimistic as always.
Really?
Yeah, so it's 2.8
EDM. Yeah, thank you very much. I have a question for the King plot analysis, because in a sense, it's a kind of a blessing if your ytterbium deformation, so to speak, tells you immediately that there's something else ongoing. But if you now go to a mildly deformed region, how do you disentangle then the new physics from some not understood nuclear physics? So what is there any recipe? Because in the EDM community, it's clear what there is a clear signal, and then you can tell immediately what's going on. But what is the future of this kind of King plot analysis?
There is no future for the heavy elements. I'm probably Vladimir Vuletic would probably say something different. Dima Butka would say what I'm saying. So the sad story is. So, you know, there's this many different terms, the field shift, the mass shift, the high order field shift, and so on. And the, in the end, it turns out to be like 5 or 6 or 7 different terms. And you cannot cancel all of them, because ytterbium offers only like 5 stable isotopes. That gives you 4 differences. So you can only measure 4 terms. And these are already absorbed by, let's say, the field shift, the mass shift, second order field shift, and quadruple deformations. So unless somebody comes up with a clever idea or another approach to the math that we are using, I believe that these heavy elements, where we have this dominant quadruple deformation that mask everything else, we will not be able to disentangle new physics and the higher order terms, just because we don't have sufficiently many isotopes.
But why is it better than in the light ones? So,
because the light ones have much less of these nuclear deformations, and because the field shift is much smaller in calcium, for example. Mm-hmm. So the second order field shift is again suppressed by a lot. And one could hope that the second order terms are so small that the new physics terms dominate. This was a surprise that the terbium, was a surprise and was a bad surprise that in all of these heavy relativistic nuclei, the deformation are so strong that they entirely mask whatever you could hope to see in terms of new physics. That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you.
But there's hope. I'm sorry for interrupting again. There is tin, for example. If any one of you wants to write like an ERC grant, go for tin. That one is still open. Tin has, I think, 7 or 8 stable isotopes. It has many different transitions of the highly charged states. And then tin with these, I don't know, 7 or 8 different isotopes, that should allow them to cancel 7 or 8 different terms. It's not so heavy, so it should have relatively mild deformations. So tin, I believe, is probably the prime candidate element that has sufficiently many isotopes and transitions to cancel many of these terms. And then, you know, you're peeling off another layer of the onion, and then maybe you reach the beyond standard model term. So yeah, tin is the promise.
So I have a question about the magnetic deformance from the mercury, the surprising results that you found. Because you showed the show where it was in the blue, so there was no deformant. And then you, what was that based on? Is that a theoretical, is there predictions that this was not deformed?
Actually, I don't know. I don't have the citation here, but it's here. So the paper is down here. I'm not a nuclear physics guy, so I don't know. But somebody with better understanding can probably look at the paper and tell us what calculations went in there.
There's somebody here. Yeah, let me. Nope, nobody knows. Yeah. And does this deformation also impact like the EDM efforts?
Yes, I hope in a positive way. Again, I'm not an expert. From what I heard is that the nuclear EDM is amplified through nuclear deformations, right? That's why people use radium and so on. And the amplification factor can be positive or negative and can be large or small. I think the amplification factor in ytterbium is smaller than 1 for some reason. In radium is like 4,000 or so. And in mercury, believed it was a few, like 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or so. Maybe it turns out that if we now find that the mercury nucleus is more deformed than we thought, then this amplification factor might be a little bit larger. It's not going to be as large as in radium, but the impact could be that the EDM that we are searching for and might find in the end has a certain amplification factor that is larger than expected, yes.
Okay, that's very interesting. Skylar, yeah. You want...
I mean, if I can jump in, I think mercury is actually a great example of the complementarity of all of these atomic EDM systems and a place where additional nuclear structure information would have a huge impact, because it's already a very constraining experiment from the precision of what Simon has told us about. But it's very difficult to say what this nuclear enhancement means, because when you break it into its component pieces, the theory uncertainties are huge. And if that situation could change, then it would be one of the most powerful constraints, both from a theoretical perspective and from an experimental one.
Well, thanks. It's very encouraging to hear these words from somebody who understands the physics behind it.
Well, you might get a contradicting opinion from someone else who does right now.
No, not at all. Tim Chupp here. So I could you just reiterate the, I guess, prognosis for the EDM experiment in Mercury, please?
Yes. I have this chart here that is already almost 10 years old. Here is it. Yeah, so we're just putting assumptions to the electric field that we can get, to the spin coherence time, to the atom number and the measurement time. Then we come up with this design sensitivities. That's all that we have so far. And then we compare that to the, well, you know this much, much better than anybody else does, to the old room temperature Mercury experiment. And on paper, we can say that this has the potential to be orders of magnitude better.
So my question is really, what is it going to take to get moving on that or towards that goal?
In the end, it's people. So I'm lacking PhD students. we have the ideas. I think there's, so the problem that I'm foreseeing in the end is the differential polarizability of the dipole trap of the two MF states that we are probing. So this could be an issue of which I'm not entirely sure of how and how well we can solve this. So in the end, we're holding entities in the dipole trap. And if you look at the atomic physics parts very closely, the polarizability, so the force that these atoms see, depends on the MF state in the end, because the dipole trap will never be 100% linearly polarized. There's always going to be some elliptical contribution in there, because the windows of the vacuum system by refringing, and because, well, even the best Wollaston prisms give you like 1 in a million or so polarization cleanliness. So here I didn't put in numbers yet, but we can't expect the polarization of the dipole trap to be infinitely good. That means we have some residual differential force, or not force, but trapping potential on the MF states, which in the end would look like an EDM. And this is something that we have to carefully take care of. I can't tell you at this point under what assumptions, what limitations this would give in the end. But this is going to be the largest systematic that today I could think of.
Tim gives you a thumbs up.
Hi, Simon. It's Philip Schmidt-Wellenburg. One thing on this table, kind of I have a naive question. So they, in original Seattle, had a design sensitivity which was 2 × 10⁻³. So where did they lose the three orders of magnitude nearly?
I think it was there was sort of arcing, so sparks from one electrode to the other. That caused, there were not sort of direct sparks, but sort of spiraling across the little cells. And this led to an uncontrolled change in the B field. And they suffered a lot from this sort of arcing. And from what I understand, they couldn't optimize the experiments on the short noise of the detection, but on the short noise of the sparks that were flying from one electrode to the other. But there's probably people from the audience that can have a much better understanding of what in the end led the Seattle experiment to have a real sensitivity that's all of magnitude below the design sensitivity.
Maybe not, but I have another question. So you said with the 185 laser, you improved the signal to noise. Would you be able to elaborate on that a little bit more? So how does this work?
Yeah, so thus far, people used the 254 nanometers to set the atoms in motion, as you say, to start the spin precession, also to read out the spin precession via the Faraday rotation. This works very well, but might not be the best approach. So one thing you could think of is to do map the state of the atoms using a different approach, and the different approach could be fluorescence or absorption detection, where the alignment of the transition you're using matters. So then you can try, you can look at different approaches. One is you do destructive measurements, that you just allow the spin precession to take place for, let's say, I don't know, a minute or so, then just map or measure the number of atoms in each spin state. Yeah, you can also try to fantasize even more that you are having not sort of cold but thermal clouds of atoms, but the general cloud of atoms. Then they would have sort of phase coherence across the cloud. And then you can do interference measurement by expanding to adjacent clouds, which are sitting sort of, yeah, maybe one step back. So suppose you have a ground plane in the center, and then you have an electric B field pointing upwards above the plane and downwards below the plane. And then you trap two degenerate Fermi gases, one in one combination of B and E field and the other in the other combination. And then you allow them to spin precess for a while, and then you interfere them after a minute or so. And then you can do interference of these two degenerate samples and do absorption imaging and directly read out the phase this way. So this then would need high resolution and high signal imaging, where the 185 nanometer would be beneficial. So you're right in the sense that the taking advantage of the broad line width and large signal strength of the 185 would probably require a different imaging technique or detection technique than just the Faraday rotation of the spin precession.
Yeah, it sounds very exciting. Thank you.
So I think in view of time, we should, because even with our extra slot, we are back to the original schedule, essentially. So thank you again for giving the talk and the questions.
Sure. Thanks a lot. Thanks for joining.
I think there's coffee now, and we should reconvene at 11:30.
Okay. See you all, hopefully, in person next time.
Thanks. Yeah, indeed. Thanks.
Thanks, Steven. Well, thanks for working with us and being patient.
No worries.
Would upload them or what do?
Yes, if you upload them on Indica, that's perfect. Mm-hmm.